First of all, I want to thank the organizers for making possible this nice conference and also for giving me the chance to talk here. The title of my talk is a quantum gravity extension of the inflationary scenario. And essentially, I want to summarize work done in collaboration with Abhay Ashrekar and William Nelson at Penn State. So let me start with a motivation of my talk. So LQG, as you know, is a quantum approach to gravity. And that we all like and appreciate, and it is based on nice mathematical, nice physical ideas and a beautiful mathematical formulation. However, as you know, it is not complete. There are some important open issues that still remain. And in this talk, we will see a lot of efforts trying to address them, new physical ideas, new sophisticated mathematical techniques, and that try to overcome these open issues. But what I want to emphasize that in addition to this effort in fundamental aspects of the theory, it is also important to develop approximate methods. They should have the goal of coarse graining over the details of technical details of the theory and extract the physical consequences in a way that suitable to solve concrete problems. And this is important because they will make the theory closer and useful to other communities. As you will see, for instance, in cosmology, there are open issues related to quantum gravity, and people in cosmology will appreciate our effort if we can address them in some way. And this talk is a step in that direction in the context of cosmology. And see also these other talks for related work. So in this talk, I want to focus on the inflationary scenario. You may wonder why, and the reason is simple. It's because it is the most accepted framework by far to account for the origin of cosmic inhomogeneities. So it makes sense to start talking about this model. So let me summarize what inflation is doing in just a couple of minutes. So in this plot, time goes vertical and physical length here. The red line represents the evolution of the Hubble radius, the inverse of the Hubble rate. And which is an inflation starts here and ends here, and during inflation the Hubble rate is constant, the Hubble radius is constant, and gives you an idea of the size of the scale space-time curvature. The blue line is the evolution of a single wavelength of a Fourier mode. So if you consider a scalar field, for instance, you Fourier expand, you pay attention to a single Fourier mode. This is the evolution of its wavelength. It evolves exponentially with time during inflation in such a way that at the onset of inflation, it is much smaller than the scale of curvature. So it is too energetic to feel the curvature. It lives like in Minkowski spacetime. But then inflation stretches out the wavelength until it becomes comparable to the scale of curvature. And now if we go to a book of quantum field theory in spacetime, that tells us that the interaction of this quantized perturbation with the spacetime curvature is able to excite quanta from the field in such a way that even if this mode was in the vacuum state initially, the interaction with the curvature is able to produce quanta from the vacuum, and at the end of inflation, we will have a primordial spectrum of perturbations, and what is non-trivial is that the predictions are in total agreement with observations. So this is the way in which inflation works, and during inflation, the energy scale is much below the Planck energy density, and the wavelength that we have to pay attention to are above the Planck scale. So it is safe to describe perturbations using standard quantum field theory in classical spacetimes. However, before inflation, the energy scale is comparable to the Planck scale. The wavelengths are comparable to the length to the Planck length. So we need quantum gravity. And so we have no idea yet of what is happening before inflation, and we need a theory of quantum gravity to solve it. In particular, there are some open questions in inflation, and let me summarize them. So first of all, there is a problem about what is the origin of the scalar field and what is the origin of the potential driving inflation. That problem comes from particle physics, and I will not discuss it. Rather, I will focus on quantum gravity issues. For instance, in inflationary spacetimes, the Big Bang singularity is always present. So the question is there a singularity-free scenario from which inflation arises from? Second, what are the initial conditions of inflation? So if we don't know what is happening before inflation, the initial conditions should depend on that part of the space-time. So what are the initial conditions for inflation? Also, what happens when the wavelength of the modes become transplanckian? And also, is this part of the space-time important for prediction? So are the predictions of inflation sensitive to what is happening before inflation? And in this talk, I want to use loop quantum cosmology. Doesn't work very well. To address these questions. And I will do it in two steps. And these two steps will be the two parts of my talk. The first one, I want to learn how quantum perturbations propagate in a quantum space-time. So how cosmological perturbation theory can be extended to quantum space-times. This mathematical part, the first point, is not tied to inflation. It's more general and can be applied to other scenarios. But once I have it, then I will apply it to study the phenomenology of the pre-inflationary universe. Thank you. Now I have two. So the first part, cosmological perturbation theory in quantum space-times, and the second part, the pre-inflationary universe of loop quantum cosmology. So let's go to the first part. I will divide it in three points: strategy, classical theory, and quantum theory. So strategy. So the strategy to study perturbations in the quantum theory could be to follow the same strategy as in classical cosmology, which is take the full theory and linearize it around Freeman-Robertson-Walker backgrounds. However, that is not possible because we don't have the full theory. So we don't have the full Einstein equations to linearize. So we have to follow a different approach. Progress recently has been obtained by focus only on the sector of GR of interest. So go at the classical level, the classical phase space, reduce it using the symmetries of our problem in particular, and then quantize that reduced space using loop quantum gravity. And this is the strategy that I want to follow. What I will do is to focus on the sector of the GR phase space given by especially flat Friedman Robertson Walker plus first order perturbations. So I want to increase the phase space to include first order perturbations and then quantize everything using loop quantum gravity techniques. So let me go to the classical framework. Let me summarize it. I mean, this is very well known material, so I will go fast. I will skip technical details, but I want to summarize what is the logics behind this approach because it's important for what I will say after that. So our system is gravity plus a scalar field. And if we use, let me use ADM variables for brevity, but the same is true for connection variables. The only thing I have to add is the Gauss constraint. So the phase space is given by two pairs of conjugate variables, the metric ones and the matter ones. And we have the standard scalar and vector constraints. So the next step is to consider a one-parameter family of points in the phase space, gamma of epsilon, in such a way that for epsilon equals zero, gamma of epsilon belongs to the background phase space, so the background point in the phase space around which we want to expand, so the Friedman-Robertson-Walker background. And now we expand around epsilon equals zero, and all the variables are expanded in background, plus first order, plus second order, et cetera, et cetera. In addition, because we want to expand around Friedman-Robertson-Walker, we can fix the gauge at the background level by introducing this fiducial flat metric in such a way that our dynamical variables are the blue ones. Then the next step is truncate this theory and forget about anything of second order or higher. Just keep background and first order perturbations. And that will be our truncated theory. This is the theory that we want to focus on. So our truncated theory will be made of a background part with background variables and a part which depends on first order perturbations. And additionally, mathematically, it's convenient to choose these first order perturbations as purely inhomogeneous in the sense that their integral over the space is zero, because in that way they are orthogonal to the background ones in the L squared norm. So in this way, the structure of the phase space is the structure of a normal bundle of background degrees of freedom and first order perturbations. And the symplectic structure also splits into parts. So this is the mathematical structure of the classical theory that we want to pay attention. And the next step is to consider constraints. So we have all the constraints and we have to expand them in background, first order, second order, etc. So the zero order ones only depend on the background degrees of freedom. They do not depend on perturbations. The vector one is trivially zero because we fixed the gauge at the background level, and the scalar one is the familiar one, which is nonlinear in background variables, and it generates the time evolution on the background degrees of freedom. It gives us the standard Friedman equation for metric and the standard equation for the inflow field, for the scalar field. So we can solve them and obtain A of t and phi of t. So the whole evolution. And it's important that this evolution doesn't know anything about perturbations. It's independent on perturbation. So then first order constraints, they are linear in first order perturbations. So only inhomogeneous lapses contribute, otherwise this integral is trivially zero. And they are real constraints on the phase space of first order perturbations. So they are telling us, as usual, that our degrees of freedom are not physical. Some of them are just pure gauge. And we can just solve the constraints to find gauge invariant variables. So we can use the constraints to move from the initial variables to the gauge invariant variables. And a simple counting tells us that there are only three gauge invariant variables, one scalar modes and two tensor modes, and the corresponding conjugate momenta. So our phase space is the truncated, reduced phase space, because we have reduced two gauge invariant variables, made of background and gauge invariant first order perturbation. So this is our truncated reduced phase space that we want to quantize. The second, the remaining thing is second order constraints. They have terms which are quadratic in first order perturbations, as well as terms linear in second order perturbations. But if we restrict the constraint to the reduced phase space, we have to forget about second order perturbations. And the remainder thing is no longer a constraint. It's only quadratic in first order perturbations. It is not a constraint, but it generates the time evolution of first-order perturbations. So it provides a well-defined Hamiltonian to evolve first-order perturbations. For instance, for the tensor modes, this is the form. It is quadratic in first-order perturbations and the conjugate momenta, and it depends on background functions. However, these background functions are known. They are given by the zero-order constraints, so they are known, and this is the Hamiltonian. And if we use, for instance, conformal time, which corresponds to this lapse, this is the wave equation, which is the familiar equation for tensor modes in cosmology. And this is just a field theory on a fixed given Friedman-Robertson-Walker background. So just let me summarize in a picture what is happening here. So we have our truncated phase space, reduced truncated phase space. If we focus on the homogeneous and isotropic subspace, the dynamics is given by this vector field, which is generated by the zero order constraint. This evolution is independent of perturbations, doesn't know anything about perturbations. And now we can add this Hamiltonian to lift this trajectory to the full phase space in such a way that we have the whole dynamical trajectory. But note that this is made of two parts, one for the background and one for perturbations. So dynamics is not generated by a single Hamiltonian. So one could think a priori that dynamics is generated by this Hamiltonian, the sum of the two Hamiltonians, but it is not. Because if we use this Hamiltonian to work to obtain the equation of motion, we realize that there is a term this introduces in the background equations, a term which is quadratic in first order perturbations. So this will introduce part of the back reaction of perturbations on the background. And this is not what our theory is giving us. Our theory, the truncated theory, is given by this. It's not generated by a Hamiltonian, but this is fine because the theory is not complete. It's just a truncated theory. And the main approximation behind this construction is that back reaction of perturbations on the background is neglected. So what is the regime of validity of the theory? It is clear because the main approximation is that we are neglecting back reaction. This theory is valid in the regimes in which the stress energy tensor of perturbations is negligible as compared to that of the background. So this is the condition under which this framework makes sense. And now what I want to do is to quantize this classical framework. So usually in a standard classical cosmology, one starts with the Hamiltonian for perturbations and one quantizes first order perturbations. What I want to do now is to put a hat also on background variables and quantize everything. So we have to quantize everything. The mathematical structure of the phase space suggests that the Hilbert space of our full theory should have the product structure. So the states will be product of background and perturbations. And this structure should be true as long as back reaction is negligible. And now, in order to quantize it, I want to follow exactly the same strategy as before. I want to solve for the background, which evolves independently of perturbations. And once I obtain the evolution of the background, I will study how perturbations evolve in those given fixed quantum backgrounds. So the dynamics of the perturbations will be, as in the classical theory, generated by this Hamiltonian that now is a quantum operator. And I can work out the Heisenberg equations for perturbations. Let me use as a time variable the scalar field itself, because this is the time variable that is useful in the quantization of the background. So let me use that as a time that corresponds to these labs. And now the Heisenberg equations are just generated by Hamiltonian via commutators, and these are the Heisenberg equations for the variable and for the perturbation and the conjugate momentum. As you see, in these equations, we have operators for perturbations as well as for the background. So we have quantum things everywhere, and this is kind of complicated. But now, at this point, is where our truncated theory is very useful, because our truncated theory tells us that in the absence of back reaction, if we apply the test field approximation, that we know what are the solutions for the background. We know a priori what is the background. It is fixed once for all and doesn't depend on perturbations. So we can take the known background and take in these equations expectation value with respect to it, in such a way that background operators will be replaced by expectation values of the background operator. And this is the equations that we get. So if you see, these are the equations of a quantum field in which the coefficients are not classical functions, as in classical cosmology. They are given by expectation values of the quantum geometry. So this is really a quantum field theory on a quantum space-time. And to me, what is remarkable is that these equations are relatively simple and tell us that from all the complications of the quantum geometry, only two moments, two expectation values of the quantum geometry affect perturbations. So perturbations are only sensitive to this couple of expectation values. And remember that these equations are exact, and the only approximation is the test field approximation. There is no other approximation in this framework. So these are our equations, and these are the moments of the quantum geometry that are seen by perturbations. This is our theory. In addition, if we do some simple mathematical manipulations, it is easy to realize, to see that these two equations, that this theory is mathematically indistinguishable from a quantum field theory on a quantum, on a smooth Freeman Robertson Walker metric. So those equations are equivalent to the equations of a quantum field living in a smooth metric, which in conformal time takes this form, in such a way that the scale factor now is given by this. So this equation, this theory is a quantum field theory living in this space-time with this scale factor. So that metric, of course, does not satisfy the Einstein equations, not even the effective equations of loop quantum cosmology. This metric encodes all the quantum information that is seen by perturbations. So the quantum geometry appears in such a way that it can be codified in a smooth metric with this scale factor. And this is what we call effective dress, because it's dressed by quantum perturbations background metric. And it contains both the peak of the wave function and also perturbations, and also quantum fluctuations. And if we work out the equation of motion, the final equation of motion of our theory have the same form as in the classical theory, but now the background variables contain the quantum information coming from this metric. And this is our theory. Now, let me mention two things before changing field. So this construction has been formal so far, because I haven't specified all the objects that appear here. So first of all, we need a quantum theory of gravity providing the quantization of the background, what is the Hilbert space, what are the operators, etc. And then we can use loop quantum cosmology to do that. So this will take care of the details of the background quantization. And now for perturbations, I told you what is the equation of motion. But as you know, the quantum field theory is much more than the equation of motion. We need a Hilbert space. We need a representation of operators on that Hilbert space. We need renormalization if it is needed. But the point is that because this theory is mathematically equivalent to a quantum field theory in curved space-time, I can import all the machinery of quantum field theory in curved space-time. So I can import all what is known there. For instance, I can use the adiabatic approach to construct explicitly the Hilbert space of this theory, which is made of fourth adiabatic order states. And also, I can represent quantum operators on that Hilbert space. And even if I consider operators which are quadratic in the field operators, this theory tells us how to renormalize them and have a finite expectation value. And second, what is the self-consistency? So the test field approximation has been essential in the construction. So this theory is true as long as the back reaction of perturbations of the background is neglected. So the regime of validity is in which back reaction is neglected. So the question is there a physical interesting subspace of the full Hilbert space on which back reaction is negligible, so in which the expectation value of the stress tensor of perturbations is negligible as compared to the background, during the whole dynamical evolution? If the answer is yes, then this theory has an interesting domain of validity. And we have to check that in our applications. And you will see later at the work conditions, the answer is yes in inflationary spacetimes. So in summary, the quantum theory of cosmological perturbations in classical spacetimes can be extended to a self-consistent quantum field theory on quantum backgrounds. The quantum fields propagate as if they were in a spacetime with a smooth metric that encodes the information of the quantum geometry. And this theory provides a kind of bridge between quantum gravity and a standard quantum field theory in curved spacetimes. So let me move to the second part of the talk. The pre-inflationary universe of loop quantum cosmology. So what I want to do here is to consider the inflationary spacetime and try to complete this part of the diagram using the theory that I just presented. And essentially, what we will do will be to choose some initial conditions for perturbations at the background at the bounds, and then propagate them until the end of inflation and see what are observables and check if this phase of the universe can produce something in observables at the end of inflation. And for concreteness, it will use a quadratic potential for the inflaton field. So before going to the details, let me give you an intuitive idea of something. Why pre-inflationary dynamics should matter? So I am asking this because there is an extended intuition in cosmology that whatever happens before inflation should not influence observations, so that So the pre-inflationary universe, so the predictions of inflation are insensitive to the pre-inflationary universe. So is that true? And this is what I want to discuss. So let me see. So in my opinion, this intuition comes from general relativity. And let me explain why. So let me consider this diagram. This diagram, this is the onset of inflation, is just, let me go back, is just this part of this diagram. So in this diagram, the red line, as before, is the curvature radius, the radius of curvature, the inverse of the curvature, and the blue lines are the wavelength of the modes that we can see in the CMB. So at the onset of inflation, they are much smaller than the radius of curvature, so they do not feel the curvature, they are too energetic to feel the space-time curvature. And in GR, if we propagate everything backwards in time, this is the evolution until the Big Bang, and that continues to be true all the way to the Big Bang. So the modes never feel the space-time curvature, in such a way that if they are born in the ground state at the Big Bang, then they will remain in the ground state. So geometry do not modify the evolution of the modes. And this is why people believe that the pre-inflationary universe doesn't affect the evolution of the modes, and predictions are insensitive to this part. But the question is that true in loop quantum cosmology? So in loop quantum cosmology, if we propagate everything backwards in time, we find this picture. So first of all, there is no Big Bang singularity because quantum effects. So the radius of curvature doesn't go to zero. It gets a minimum value. And the modes doesn't go to zero. It gets a minimum value in such a way that it is true that for some modes, they are always much smaller than the radius of curvature. But there are other modes which feel the curvature at some time, like, for instance, this mode. So we expect that this mode, even if it is born in the ground state here, the interaction with the curvature will excite quanta and will modify the state in which this mode is. So it is expected that this phase of the universe will modify the state of this mode and can modify predictions. So in loop quantum gravity, one expects that geometry can modify the observational predictions. And we expect that for large wavelength, so for short momenta, we expect big corrections. And for a small wavelength, so large co-moving momenta, we expect no corrections. So this is what we expect from this qualitative picture. And let's see if computations realize this picture. So let's go to computations. So the first point is obviously about initial conditions, and this is an important point. So first of all, because in loop quantum cosmology, the bounds is a preferred time, so it seems natural to impose initial conditions at the bounds, and we need both initial conditions for the background and for perturbations. So for the background, what we will use is the quantum states that have been studied carefully by many people in loop quantum cosmology. So let me remind you quickly what they are. They are coherent states, which are highly peak in a classical trajectory at late times. And people have shown that if one propagates those coherent states backward in time, they remain highly peak along the whole dynamical trajectory. So quantum fluctuations are small. And in addition, the peak of that wave function is well described by effective trajectories. And what is remarkable is that these effective trajectories are uniquely characterized by the value of the inflaton field at the bounds. So the value of phi, the scalar field at the bounds, phi b. This uniquely characterizes the evolution of the peak of the wave function. And that is true because the bounds is very universal, because the energy density is fixed and is a bounds. And this parameter varies in this range. So to summarize, the initial conditions that we want to consider for the background are highly peak states in a classical trajectory at late times, characterized by a value of phi bounds in this regime. Second, for perturbations, we go to the Hilbert space of perturbations and we try to look for a state which is preferred with respect to other states. But we realize that, as happens in quantum field theory in curved space-time, in the Hilbert space, there is no preferred state. There is no state that we can call the vacuum. And the reason is that we don't have enough symmetries. For instance, in Minkowski space-time or the Sitter space, the symmetries are strong enough to uniquely characterize a preferred state. But here, the only symmetries we have is homogeneity and isotropy, and they are not strong enough to select a unique vacuum state. But we can follow the same principles that select the Minkowski vacuum or the Sitter vacuum, that is, impose the symmetries that we have, and UV ultraviolet regularity. And this couple of symmetries select not a unique state, but a family of states, and these are the family that we want to consider. And they are the fourth order adiabatic vacuum. So these are the family of states that we want to consider at the bounds for perturbations. But you may wonder, what does it mean physically? What physically means to have an adiabatic vacuum for perturbations at the bounds? So physically, this is equivalent to impose quantum homogeneity at the time of the bounds. To assume that at the bounds there are no perturbations beyond quantum fluctuations. So perturbations are as small as quantum mechanics allows. And it is true that this is a strong assumption, because in particular, we know that in loop quantum cosmology, before the bounds, we have an infinite branch of a contracting universe. So why perturbation should be in the vacuum at the bounds? Well, our motivation is that at the bounds, the observable universe has a radius equal or smaller than 10 Planck length, so it is super small. And at those scales, we know that the quantum repulsive force that produces the bounds, it is effective enough to dilute any structure coming from the previous branch. So it is plausible that this additional ingredient introduced by LQC, this quantum repulsive force producing the bounds, is able to dilute inhomogeneities, at least in our observable patch, and make perturbations in the vacuum state, at least in the patch that we can see. So this is our motivation. So now what we do is to consider perturbations and propagate them until the end of inflation and compute observables. So the first observable is the power spectrum for scalar perturbations as a function of k. So red crosses are just the exact results for a given k. The black line is the average, and the red line that I don't know if you can see it is over here, are the standard predictions of inflation. So what we see is that for large k, loop quantum cosmology introduces no effects. The predictions agree with those of a standard inflation. And this is what we were expecting at the beginning. However, for large wavelengths, the corrections are more important. We find oscillations, and in average, we have an increase of power for low k. So these are our results, oscillations and large power in average for small case. And the first question is this plot, does this plot depend on the initial conditions we have chosen, on the particular initial conditions we have chosen? And the answer is surprising, it's almost not, at least in the parameter space we have been able to explore. So first of all, this plot is quite insensitive to the chosen fourth adiabatic order vacuum. So we have tried several, and it is true that the crosses change a little bit, but the whole qualitative picture remains the same. This plot is also essential to the chosen value of the inflaton field at the bounds inside the range we have explored. So the value of the inflaton field at the bounds tells you essentially how much expansion you have between the bounds and the offset of inflation. And this plot is quite insensitive to that. What is important is that phi bounds changes what is the range of modes in that plot that we can see. So we can see in the CMB only a finite range of modes from some k minimum to 2,000 times that k minimum. And the value of k minimum depends on phi bounds. So for instance, if phi bounds is 1.1, k minimum is 0.14, so it is right here. So it goes for 2,000 times. If it is 1.2, the minimum k that we can see in the CMB is right here. And if it is 1.3, it is 500. So the first conclusion is that if phi bounds is larger than 1.2, then the observable range of modes start right here and goes over there. So the loop quantum gravity corrections are negligible. So this is our first conclusion. What about tensor modes? For tensor modes, we see exactly the same. So our plot is qualitatively the same for tensor modes. So oscillations and large power for low k. We can also compute the tensor to scalar ratio, so the ratio between tensor and scalar. And we see that the loop quantum cosmology corrections are the same for both, so they cancel out, and our tensor to scalar ratio is the same as the standard one in inflation. So this is another result. And another result is about the so-called inflationary consistency relation. This consistency relation relates the tensor to scalar ratio with the tensor spectral index. This quantity is just the slope of the power spectrum for tensor modes. In inflation, in normal inflation, one doesn't have this term, but in loop quantum cosmology, we do not modify R, but we modify NT. So this is the new consistency relation that we are obtaining. And this is, of course, important. So just to summarize, so from the initial range of initial conditions for the background, we see that if phi bounds is smaller than 0.93, the predictions are incompatible with observations. So the predictions is we don't have enough inflation. And if we have enough inflation, the power spectrum is too large. So the CMB is constraining our initial parameter space. So for phi bounds larger than 1.2, we obtain negligible effects coming from loop quantum cosmology. So we have just the standard results of inflation. And so we are just providing a quantum gravity extension of the standard inflationary paradigm by resolving the Big Bang singularity and including the pre-inflationary phase, but the predictions are the same. And there is a small range, which is quite small compared to the whole range, in which some deviations may appear. And those deviations are oscillations and larger power spectrum for scalar and tensor modes for low k, and a modification of the inflationary consistency relation. And just the last point that I want to discuss, what about self-consistency? So is back reaction really negligible in those solutions that we are considering? And this is non-trivial because at the Planck regime, quantum fluctuations may spoil back reaction. So we have numerically computed the expectation value of the energy density for perturbations and compare it with the background one. This computation is non-trivial, it's challenging numerically because you have to renormalize, and renormalization in numerics is very complicated. One requires numerical cancellation of quantities that diverge. So numerical issues appear, and we are only able to obtain upper bounds for this quantity. But so far, we have been able to show that so these upper bounds are good enough to show that for this regime, back reaction is in fact negligible at any time during inflation, even in the quantum regime. And this is a highly non-trivial part of our analysis because these computations are non-trivial conceptually and numerically. So we have been able to show that there exists a subset of the phase space, which is small compared to the whole phase space, Hilbert space, in which self-consistency is negligible. So we have shown the existence of self-consistent solutions to our theory. So existence of self-consistent quantum extensions of the inflationary space-time. And just to summarize this part of the talk, the second part, we have extended the picture of the genesis of cosmic inhomogeneities to include Planck scale physics. For most of the parameter space, we find a self-consistent extension of the inflationary scenario. And there exists a small window for which new predictions may arise. And this may open a window to test quantum gravity in cosmology. This is essentially all what I want to say. Thank you.
Ivan, thank you very much. This is very impressive, it's really wonderful that you get there. So I say that because don't take this question as a criticism. It's just I want a clarification. It seems to me, but maybe I'm confused. This is a question about the approximations on which this is based. So on what's beyond the matter. You have clarified very well in the classical theory what is disregarding, when it's just throwing away the back reaction and the higher order dynamics of the perturbation. Now, once you go to the quantum theory, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is an additional, there are two approximations, one in the classical theory and one in the quantum theory, when you expect that the state remains a tensorial state in the, so, and in fact you said that in the, this is, so, you're neglecting the back reaction and you're also neglecting the fluctuations of the background, the delta of the background. Is that, at the end, you sort of check the first one, what do we know about the, so is there space for some other physics which is given by the quantum fluctuation of the background, and the effect not of the excitation values, but actually fluctuations.
Thank you. Our understanding is that both approximations go in tandem. So if I go to the to that part of the talk, it was here in that part of the talk. So we are assuming that the back reaction is negligible, so the evolution of the background is independent of what perturbations are doing. So background evolves, doesn't know anything about perturbations. It has its quantum fluctuations. Perturbations have their quantum fluctuations, but they don't talk to each other because these are much smaller than this one. So in fact, we are including the quantum fluctuations of the background in our analysis. If you see here, this expectation value is not the product of expectation values. So here, quantum fluctuations are included. And in fact, these are all the quantum fluctuations that affect. So we are not, at the theoretical level, we are not saying that this is the same as expectation value minus 1/2 times expectation value to the fourth. So quantum fluctuations are present in the theory. So it includes the quantum fluctuations of the background, and we assume that perturbation doesn't modify them. So this is our assumption. Another thing is at the practical level. At the practical level, in computations, we are choosing highly peak states of the quantum geometry. And for those states, as I said, the quantum fluctuations are very small. And then in those computations, we are neglecting the quantum fluctuation. Because one can check that the error one makes but neglect them are even smaller than the numerical errors themselves. So these are the 2 points. They are included at the theoretical level. And back reaction, if back reaction is negligible, this is consistent. And at the practical level, because of the state that we consider, we are neglecting them.
All right. I have a question which is related, which is in some sense about the consistency of the approximation. So I'm trying to understand the physical picture. I would imagine physically that, let's say, for the mode that couples to the bounds, so at the time it becomes really quantum, this mode that couples to the bounds would be exactly the same time at which somehow back reaction effect matters. So I would expect naturally that the only thing where your approximation is consistent is when, you know, you don't see any quantum gravity effects. So can you explain physically why you would expect this decoupling of, you know, no back reaction to be valid in this deep quantum regime?
I think this is the technical, non-trivial part of our computation. So a priori, one could expect that at late times, as you said, back reaction is negligible because we know that quantum field theory works and fluctuations are small. And one expects that in the full quantum regime, everything becomes entangled. So, but a big effort in our results, in our work, has been precisely to compute if that is true or not. And what we find is that there are many states for both quantum background and perturbations for which back reaction is important. So at the Planck scale, everything gets together and that picture is right. But there are a family of states which are interested phenomenologically from which back reaction is just small. So one can compute it explicitly, compute what is the size of the fluctuations of the perturbations and see explicitly that they are small compared to the background. So this is the result of a computation. Right. I mean, this is in the exactly. This is in the bridge between. So, what we have been able to show that for those states for which the quantum gravity effects are starting to be small, back reaction is negligible. But from computations, I really think that this is a numerical issue and that should be true also when the quantum gravity effects are important. Because if you see, those quantum gravity effects are just coming from how perturbations fill the geometry. So there is no reasons to believe that should not be true for a smaller value. But please keep in mind that we are Fock quantizing perturbations. We are not loop quantum gravity quantizing perturbations. So if one takes perturbations as loop quantized, it is possible that new effects of that kind appear. But for our theory, I believe that can be, back reaction can be extended to the regime in which quantum gravity is important.
I have a comment concerning this Drest metric. So this Drest metric works, according to me and Andrea Dapor, it works well only for massless modes. However, if you would like to find a Drest metric for massive modes, then there is still one more condition, which cannot be satisfied by isotropic metric. However, we found a non-isotropic Drest metric, Bianchi type 1, and the conclusion is that even if quantum state is isotropic, then this classical Drest metric, which replaces this, which emerges to massive modes, quantum modes, it is non-isotropic, given by this metric which me and Andrea introduced. And the second comment is that from the point of view of the full, you can look at this from the point of view of the full theory. Mm-hmm. And then from the point of view of the full theory, the drawback of this approach is that actually background degrees of freedom still have non-vanishing Poisson brackets with perturbations. And in this framework, it is somehow abandoned in the classical level, and it seems to be working. However, it's non-equivalent to the full theory. And we were concerned that if we quantize, then perhaps this difference, even if it doesn't make classically any problem in doesn't cause any problem in finding solutions, maybe it has some. We know that Poisson non-commuting turns into non-commuting of operators of observables. So we proposed a different theory of perturbations in which those relations, the non-commutation between perturbations and background, is taken into account. And there are also another approaches, like by Guillermo Mena, or older approach by Gibbons, in which also those this non-commutation is taken into account. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the comments. They are
Faye.
They are extensions of this stuff, and they are very well appreciated. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I want to just follow up on Carlo and Laurent's questions and just push you a little bit further. So your claim that there is a region of some set of states in which you can describe the evolution of the universe to a good approximation by some smooth geometry, which through a region where curvatures become Planckian, that is completely counter to the general expectation in quantum gravity that when curvatures become curvature scales become Planckian, then quantum effects will be very large, and you won't be able to describe the geometry smoothly anymore. And this just is the usual derivative expansion, effective field theory expectation. So in order to be convinced that this region that you've discovered, I mean, I don't think, I'm not questioning your calculations, but to be convinced that this really is something physical that we can take seriously physically, I'd like to ask, what is the physical explanation of this region in the state space where the, where these states exist? What characterizes this region as opposed to the regions where the physically, as opposed to the regions of state space where the quantum fluctuations are large, as we expect, generically expect in quantum gravity?
Let me see if I understood your question. So I agree that in general, the intuition is that during the Planck regime, the background metric is cannot be described by a smooth metric. It's fully quantum, is described by a wave function that has quantum fluctuation. I totally agree with that. And that is fine. And but this is compatible with this. We are not saying that the metric of the space-time is doesn't contain quantum fluctuations. They are present, and if they are important, they are codified here. What we are saying is that the propagation of the modes of perturbations on that quantum geometry is mathematically equivalent to the propagation of those perturbations in a smooth metric. So that the quantum corrections that are present and the quantum fluctuations that are present appear in such a way that they can be codified mathematically in a smooth metric. So I am not claiming that, that the quantum fluctuations of the geometry are zero at the Planck phase. They can be there. But I am saying that, that that perturbations only see some moments of that quantum geometry that can be codified, that they encode in the form of a smooth metric, but only regarding propagation of perturbations.
Bill, last question. One last question here, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, still on the same topic. You have the expectation value here of these products of operators, which you say is not the product of the expectation values. But if I solve those equations, then I know that the solutions are very nonlinear functions of those coefficients, the things that you have the expectation values of there.
The solutions for what? For the
solutions of those that equation are
these couple of equations.
Yeah, are nonlinear functions of those expectation values.
Right.
Therefore, when I take the expectation value of the solution, we have exactly the same problem, namely that the expectation value of those solutions is not equal to the solution of this equation that you've written down here with the expectation values.
But here we are mixing perturbations and the background, because these are perturbations that they just live
so
on the fixed background.
Solutions of the perturbation equations as a function of the background.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have them simply being very nonlinear functions of these expectation values of the background. Whereas what they should be is the expectation values of those very nonlinear functions of those background operators, which, as you say, are not equivalent to the expectation the functions of the expectation values. And in particular, your difference is now the place where you find the difference between your theory and the standard theory is precisely at that bounce point, if you will, which is where quantum effects are very dominant in the background. So that's exactly the place where you would expect these kinds of nonlinear, you know, expectation value of a nonlinear function is not the nonlinear function of the expectation values to play their biggest role. So
I'm afraid that I don't agree with.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's doing exactly what you want to do. He's actually looking at the expectation value of those products. Now, if you say you want to take expectation values of the individual operators.
No, I'm saying that if I now solve those equations, instead of leaving those guys, those blue guys, as operators instead of expectation values, I get a very nonlinear function of those blue guys.
Yes, but the
in the solution, and the expectation values of those are not equal to the is not equal to the function of those is not equal to is not anything like
Now, I think you're confusing again perturbations and background. So the background
we're very late, so the point has been made. You can talk it later. Let's thank the speaker.